So today,
we're going to get wild.
We're going to get controversial. We're going to get unapologetic. Why would I say that? I only have to mention two words. Sean Avery, the man who's been called the most hated player in hockey. The guy you want on your team, but you hate to play against. From his bruising days as one of hockey's most infamous agitators to a career filled with chaos, both on the ice and off the ice. It is anything but smooth, this story. His critics have called him reckless and a liability. Others have praised him for his fearlessness and his ability to thrive under pressure. Love him, hate him. One thing for sure, Sean Avery doesn't do boring. So buckle up, everybody. This might be a bit raw. We're going to have fun. Welcome. How do you like that? Do you like that or not?
Oh, man.
Did your life just pass in front of you?
Yeah, because, you know, you've been a part of my life for for 30 years. But, you know, somebody, I've told multiple people that I was coming here to do this, and every single person is like in awe. They go, more.
No. Really?
No, I'm serious.
Oh, wow.
You told the Shaq story earlier.
Yeah.
You know, we grew up on you. And you've had multiple lives, but we grew up with you every single day. Like, I can vividly remember going home after school and, like, making a peanut butter sandwich before I'm going to go out and play and skate on the pond, or we're playing road hockey, and, like, Maury's on. Yeah. And that's seared into my brain, so I'm very excited.
Thank you. So I'll tell you a story about that. I've run into a lot of NFL players.
Yeah.
And they all tell me the same story. And I had to confirm it multiple times. They'd be in the locker room.
Yeah.
The show would be on.
Always.
Right?
Always.
The coaches are upstairs. They're looking at their watches. And they ain't going up until they find out who the father is.
I mean, we're not hockey players. I don't think gambling's not as big of a culture, maybe it was right. From a gambling standpoint or from a promiscuity standpoint. Maybe the football players are a little bit looser. But it was on every training room, whether we're
on
the road. Yeah, it's always because, you know, there's rows of training tables. And we don't watch the news back then. Back then, the news wasn't so polarizing. It wasn't crack. We would watch Maury. Because, you know, we're loose. We're trying to keep it loose, and the guys want to have fun. And, and I mean, Jesus, it was so much fun.
I'll tell you, the only time I ever saw more tape in a locker room other than a hockey locker room was at the National Championships Rodeo in Las Vegas.
Oh, wow.
With all those bull riders in the locker room with their tape.
Wow.
Other than that, there's more tape in your room than anybody's.
Why? Because they tape everything.
Everything.
They're just hurt.
Yeah. I mean,
real athletes.
With
those
bulls.
Guys. Yeah. No.
And bucking Broncos.
Yep.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But hockey's a close second.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of tape in your room.
A lot of tape. We actually, growing up, you would make a tape ball. That was so when we would go on the road and stay in hotels.
When you were kids.
Yeah, when we were kids. And that was the thing we played mini sticks with. So you would take the tape, and it was a sort of like an art form. Like, we weren't artists. We were young hockey players, but the tape ball had a very specific, you know, some guys could make good ones and you wanted black tape, but yes, tons of hockey tape.
Okay. So let me ask, do you wear your career as a badge? Or do you wear it as an embarrassment, or just as that's the way it went?
So I think, you know, where I'm sitting today, which is probably, I think personally, the best place I've ever been, I can look back on my career and go, oh my God, I could have been such a better player.
Oh, wow.
But I also look back and go, I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, and part of that is because of the career I had and how I played. I started taking I'm a dedicated martial artist now. Like, jiu-jitsu has sort of changed my life post hockey. But I didn't start it.
Did it calm you?
It just calmed everything. If I had have been doing jiu-jitsu when I was playing, I would have been twice the player I was, played twice as long.
Would you have been less an agitator?
Yeah, and my game would have been different. And maybe I wasn't supposed to play that way. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that, when I think about that, I go, oh, I can identify, no question I would have been a better player. But I had so much fun.
Did you have fun with 1,500 and plus penalty minutes?
Yeah. And I got
1,500 plus.
I know.
Over 12 seasons.
Yeah.
You know, that's over 100 minutes a season.
Yeah.
How about 79 majors?
Right.
Majors.
You know, Steve Yzerman told me as a rookie, and I played for Scotty Bowman in Detroit, and I played on, in my opinion, one of the best teams that I've ever been on ice, 2002 Detroit Red Wings. And I remember Stevie, and I lived with Brett Hall, who was,
by the way,
the greatest.
I love Brett Hall.
Brett's one of the greatest men ever.
I played golf with Brett.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
I love Brett.
Brett was not a good, Brett liked to see me, you know, he enjoyed me and my craziness.
He did.
He did, completely.
Why? Because there, but for the grace go I? I mean, did he think,
you know, he
if
just
he didn't
liked
have
chaos.
His father, would he be that way?
Well, and Bobby, by the way.
Pretty rough, too.
The best. I woke up one night and went down. I lived above Brett in his garage. And, you know, I woke up one night and I went down. We shared the same kitchen. And I saw Bobby Hull in his tidy whities drinking from the milk can or jar, you know, right from the
bottle.
It was a bag. It was a bag of milk. He had taken the bag of milk out of the plastic container, and it was one of the greatest things I'd ever seen. And Bobby was, you know, my dad's favorite player growing up.
Sure.
But Steve Yzerman told me.
Yeah. What did he say?
He told me I'd be a much better player, and people would like me a lot more if I just shut the fuck up.
and you didn't take that advice.
I didn't. And he reminded me over the years. Like, he would tell me it's not too late.
So what were you thinking when you stand up in front of a goalie and start waving your stick in your hands to block the vision of the goalie, and you end up having a rule named after you?
I was thinking it's better to ask forgiveness afterwards when you do something that's technically not against the rules. So going into that, what I did was actually totally legal. You know, they had to change the rule that night, which is also a crazy thing because really you're not allowed to do that. You have to go to the Board of Governors meeting in the summer and everybody has to sign off on it. I was thinking,
first of all, how did you come up with that?
Well, it was a split second. I came off the bench. Brodeur, one of the greatest goalies of all time, so wily, such a goalie that understands feel and everything around him. And every time I would go to the front of the net, he would poke me in the back of the knees and I would fall into him and I would get a penalty. And I wasn't going to outwise this wise man, you know? So it's a 5-on-3. We're in the playoffs. It's Madison Square Garden. I'm on the ice with Shanahan, Drury, Gomez, Yager, and Avery. And I'm in front of the net. I know I'm going to the front of the net. I'm not going to get the puck and playing the half wall. If I get a puck, it's going right to Yags, and I'm going back to the front of the net. I cannot take a penalty. I just got goosebumps. Like, that's what I got goosebumps about. I cannot take a penalty here. I'll let everyone down in this arena.
I mean,
I get emotional with that because it's like,
it's the garden.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's the playoffs.
Right. Right. So I just said, fuck, what if you just go and you look at him, right? If you look at him, you can see there's distance, there's separation. He can't poke me. But if I look at him, I can't screen him. So it was a split second thing. And I went for it. And I think once I put my hand in front of his face the first time and I saw his eyes, which really the only person that could see that was me and him. I saw that moment where he was seeing something for the first time in a 30 year career. And I go, holy shit, I got him. And then I got him. I got to keep going because these guys behind me are going back and forth, and one of them's going to take a one-timer, and we're trying to score. We're trying to win. And that was it. And Chris Drury was in the back door. And Drew, you can watch it. And he came over and he whispered something into my ear. He said, Coho's going to give you a penalty, because Koharski was in the corner and he was screaming at me. He was like screaming that I can't do it. He's like, and I look at him. I said, what do you mean I can't do it? I can do this.
So this is one of the refs.
Yeah. He was in over my right shoulder, and I could hear him yelling at me. And then Drew came over and he whispered into my ear, Coho is going to give you a penalty. And I don't know. I didn't think he was. I thought if he did, he can't. I knew he couldn't give me a penalty. I knew that much. And then, you know, the play happens and the puck gets moved around. And then the greatest part of the whole thing was that Gomer gets it on his stick and he puts it to me in front of the net and I score. So, you know, it was like one of those eternal moments. I'll never forget it. But what I'll never forget.
Did anybody say anything to you afterwards?
No. I went home and I woke up in the morning.
And there's the Avery rule.
And I had a missed call. And I think it was John Rosasco, our PR, head of PR, who called me and said they changed the rule last night. And I was like, what do you mean last night? When? The game was last night. But it was such a, I guess they had to, you know, because what it would have turned into a circus.
Yeah.
Would I have done it again? To what extent?
Well,
like,
let me ask you that. If they hadn't changed the rule, you're damn right you would have done
absolutely.
It again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I guess now I can think about it and go, that's probably not great for the game. You know, like it was a one-time thing. I'm okay with them changing the rule. What I don't know, and I'm pretty sure that they didn't do it, which kind of bothers me, they should have named the actual rule after me, not an addendum.
I thought they did name it.
I'm not sure if you have an actual rule book. I think the addendum
could be your finest moment.
Reference me. Yeah, I agree. I agree.
So how often have you think that you've held your tongue? Did you hold why couldn't you have held your tongue when you were all of a sudden being quoted as talking about somebody who was...
Formerly somebody that I loved.
Yeah.
I know where you're going, Maury.
Yeah. I'm you can lead me there. You can lead me there. I can do this.
Sloppy seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just said straight out, you know, I know those guys. I mean, all they're doing with my exes are getting sloppy seconds.
I'll tell you.
You know what happened to that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you lost a team.
I did. And Brett Hull was my general manager. And he was the guy that brought me there and signed me. So think about that. The guy that I lived above his garage as a rookie, he showed me the ropes. He then signs me, brings me to Dallas. And I was just so homesick for here. You know, I knew that I had made a mistake.
You love the Rangers.
Yeah. I didn't know what to do.
How did it come up?
Well, the media in Canada, much like the media anywhere, can be very, you know, they're good. They're good. And they prodded and they got me ready.
They can be tabloidy.
They poked the bear. And Brad Richards, who played for the Rangers
afterwards,
Richie was on the Stars at that point. And I remember I went into the training room and he kind of like looked at me and he was like, you won't say it. You won't say something. And I said, oh, really, Richie? I won't say something. Watch. And it was just like that. And I went out, and I'll say something about this, okay? I think your mind and your mentality changes when you become a dad for the first time, or you become a parent.
Right.
And I have a son, but I'm also extremely protective of all of his classmates in preschool, the girls, and knowing what I know now, like, we need to treasure and cherish all the women in our lives. And I loved Alicia, and I still love Alicia. She's like Canadian royalty and one of the greatest humans of all time. there's one thing in my entire career that I wish I didn't do, that I regret.
And that's
and
it.
That is it. And it's not even the Holly part
you
of
didn't,
it.
But I get the feeling you didn't do it out of pique.
I mean, I did it to throw a grenade, to drop a nuke. You know, I did it with the intent of I needed to get out of there. And that was the perfect opportunity because we were in Canada and Alicia and I had dated for a long time and we were sort of, we weren't Canadian royalty, but she's a big deal. She was on a huge show, 24.
Right.
Everyone knows her. Everyone knows her in Canada. We're very proud of our Canadian exports, especially in the arts.
Sure. Hell, half a Saturday Night Live.
Right, right. So it was just one of those things. Like, I took a shot at somebody. I just went low. And I played dirty, you know?
Yeah.
I played really dirty. That was the origin of the whole Martin Brodeur thing.
But why?
Because
you know, there are probably some who would say, well, he wasn't that good enough. He had to play dirty.
Yeah. Well, I was good enough. I mean, there was no question I was good enough. I wouldn't have been on the ice with Jágr, Shanahan,
sure, right.
Drury, Gomez, right? The question is, how much better could I have been? You know, this is what happened, I guess. My mom tells me that the first time she got a call from the school was in first grade, and we had a deaf kid in class, and I didn't believe he was deaf.
Wow.
And I, you know, shouted in his ear, and I was clapping and doing like stupid shit, you know?
Huh.
And I don't know why I did that, but I think that kind of set the tone for just the disruption that I brought to the game.
It's interesting with people who get angry, and I'm not real familiar with this, but I see it once in a while. And it's as if you pass a certain moment and then you really don't know what's happening.
Well, like the quietest moments in my life up until like the last probably 3 or 4 years were when I was fighting. Like for me, you square off at center ice at Madison Square Garden and everything goes quiet. It's like, for the love of the game, the Kevin Costner movie. Sure. I just watched it recently and they did an incredible job. He goes, clear the mechanism, and all the sound goes like, it's like whoosh. To me, the chaos was quieting for me. And that's where I felt comfortable living inside of because I was the best at it and the most effective. And you got to understand too, I was rewarded for it. Like year after year, I would constantly get rewarded.
Ultimately, are you telling me they wanted you because you were that kind?
Well, they kept...
Teams wanted you because you were that kind.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you were the disruptor.
Yeah. You know, I think great teams have so much different DNA, and they need that, you know?
Well,
I'll
tell you, in football, definitely.
Right.
They're disruptors.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, it goes all the way back. When I say all the way back, it goes all the way back to the Green Bay Packers of the 1950s and 60s when Lombardi would have people on that nobody would want.
Right.
And would stay out all night.
Yeah.
And Lombardi knew about it.
Yeah.
And let them have a pass.
Yeah.
Because they were that talented.
Yeah. Well, so, you've seen a lot of great New York football players, Boz, Lawrence Taylor, LT.
Sure.
Those guys. You know, I think to play a game that's so violent and it's kind of vicious. I mean, it really is. Like, football and hockey, very similar in the sense of everything is traumatic. It's always, it's how big are you? How strong are you? How much can we intimidate you?
Yeah.
How much can we blow through you?
So then, with all of that, how then in that game can you have the grace of a Gretzky?
Yeah.
Who's just so different.
Well, the greats are different. They're just built different. You know, they have the ability to do, like, let's use Mess for as an example. Right. Mark Messier in 94.
Right.
I mean, the epitome of a leader. They just have the ability to separate themselves. That's the difference. And by the way, you know, legends are all built in different ways, and Mess is loved in New York, but I'm also loved in New York. So it's funny how that, and I didn't win here.
Yeah, but Taylor was adored in New York.
Right.
Lawrence was adored in New
right.
York.
Right.
Even with all of his
yep.
off the field problems.
Yep. Well, because here I think, you know, New Yorkers, they want you to just play hard.
You think you're forgiven your off the field activities?
It's so funny. I was thinking about this morning, like New York in 2019. And this was kind of my moment of going like, all right, what's going to happen? I'm living in New York. I'm trying to figure out how to become an actor. I'm going to be an actor, but I'm also seeing everything happen around me. Like the city is changing. There's more Amazon drivers. There's more delivery. I can see like the city's collapsing. Mom and pops are going away. I couldn't handle it. Like I couldn't handle it. And that's where, and I, you know, this is pre-COVID. And there's a whole thing. I mean, people have made videos on YouTube, like of compositions of, I did this thing. It was a bit to me, but I became like this unofficial police of the bike lane. And I wanted to protect it. And it was an insane thing of me to do. I can't even repeat it. People laugh because they always, when I'm here in New York, they try and get me. They're like, come on, we want to see the bike lanes. And I can't get there now. So
what did you do?
I don't know. I guess I hit somebody's car with my scooter. And then I went to court and I tried to defend myself. And they found me guilty. They didn't give me any punishment. They didn't even make me pay any retribution.
Why did you do it? To keep them out of the bike lane?
I hate bullies. I hate injustice.
Whoa. You hate bullies?
Yeah.
But people thought you were a bully.
Right. But I think that I can go, you know what? Why do I hate that? I was always the smallest kid. Uh-huh. I was a small guy in a big man's game. People right. have to understand that.
Sure.
My game, the game that I played when I played.
Oh, wow. I mean, the guys now, they're huge.
They're huge, but it's, you know, and they've gotten bigger. I had a chip on my shoulder. I always had to prove myself. I always had to sort of just like cause complete, it was chaotic. I can't remember a lot of things that went on back then. Like it's starting to come to me or somebody will say something. And I'll go, no way. No way.
Let me show you the tape.
No way. I did that.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I'll tell you, somebody asked me to do my trauma tree.
What's that?
It's when you kind of take, I don't know. Well, I didn't really take a crayon, but you draw out your trauma timeline. And you try and figure out at what point in your life did you have traumatic uh-huh. things happen to you.
Right.
And then you kind of reverse engineer it and
so when did you put it?
Well, the point is that was the first time that I had heard somebody explain to me that people have like trauma from their childhood.
Do you have siblings?
I have a younger brother.
Is he?
There's 8 years between us. He's not an athlete.
And his personality is not like yours.
No, Scott is super mellow. You would never know he was in the room. He's the quietest.
Same family.
Quietest guy in the room. But what's interesting is that when I heard that, I go, what do you mean? Like everybody, a lot of people have this and they have it on different levels. Sure. Because as an athlete, there's no positivity in stepping back and thinking about that. Like I go, oh, this guy's had trauma in his life. Maybe I'll take it easy on him. No. The idea of me understanding what that is or what that was, I didn't know.
I hate playing shrink.
So good. You did it for a long time.
Yeah. You know, and quite frankly, I didn't know a thing about it. I just went with my gut.
Right. Well, it's amazing what the gut tells you, you know? Yeah.
people used to come on my show with all, try to unburden themselves with all this crap that's going on. And I never in my life experienced what they go through.
Right.
But at the same time, for some reason, they always felt safe that I was a member of the family, that I might have been an older brother or an uncle or something like that. And I never stopped to understand why, because I don't know why, and I'm not too sure I want to know.
Yeah. Think about this medium, which is new to you right now.
Exactly. I mean, fuck.
This might be the time where you do your best work.
Could be. It could be, because, you know, I've told other people, everybody knows me, you know, as, you know, you are the father, you're not the father, you passed the lie detector test, you didn't. But, you know, I had 30 years of a career before that that was a lot different, in covering great stories and being a talk show host, like a Today Show talk show host and an anchor man and a this and that. And, you know, maybe this is where I can apply that.
Yeah, well, it's also the future. It's what...
I think so.
It's what everybody's doing.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
you know, long form. I don't know if you want to do it for 3 hours at a rip, like Joe Rogan or some of these.
I don't know if I could do
that. It's a lot, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot.
I mean, I watch McAfee, for instance.
Yeah.
Holy Christ.
Yeah.
First of all, I don't think I could stand that long.
Yeah. He does stand a long time. Yeah. He was a kicker, though. He stood all the time.
That's true. You're right. He was a kicker.
He's a professional stander.
But it seems to me that you're in center ice. The yearn and the desire for you doesn't give up once you retire. You want to be an actor.
Yeah.
You're doing all kinds. You're intern at Vogue.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was while I was playing. No, when I finished playing, and it's so funny because, like, I used to make fun of the kids that did theater in school. Like, I was that guy.
Why, because you thought they were effeminate or something?
And maybe because I felt threatened by them, because they were so secure.
Oh, wow.
You know, like, so when I was done playing, Peter Berg, the great director, was a friend of mine.
Good director.
Great director. One of the best American directors. He goes, Pete's always kind of looked after me and looked out for me. He goes, I'm going to put you in a movie.
Is he Canadian?
No, but he was very close with Chris Chelios, because Pete was on Chicago Hope for a long time.
Oh.
And I played with Chelly in Detroit, so I had known Pete since I was a kid, 20, you know? And then when I came to New York and played for the Rangers, we reconnected. So when I finished playing, Pete put me in a movie called Patriots Day. It was the first time I was on set. And I'm like in a scene with Wahlberg, and it's about the...
Good movie.
Great movie. Fantastic movie. And they call action, and it's just like a fireball of energy. And I came home and I go, holy shit, that was incredible. That was the only thing that's ever felt the same as, you know, fighting it. Center Ice in Madison Square Garden. I went and found an acting coach in Union Square, and I just said, I'm going to figure out how to do this. And I guess when I think about it, you know, where I'm at now, I'm in the new Sandler movie, Happy Gilmore 2.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, which is going to be great. Like, Sandler's on fire, and it's, you know.
Everybody's in that movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of people.
I get these leaks.
You know who Bad Bunny is?
No.
Bad Bunny's in the movie.
You're kidding.
He's a big guy. He's like, he's a singer. He's a singer. But, so it's going to be great. I guess the point is that I didn't realize that, I don't know, maybe I'm more of a performer than an athlete. And when I was being an athlete, I was actually
performing. You were.
You know?
I can tell you that right now.
Right.
Because you're going to be the clip the next night, the next day on SportsCenter.
Right. And that was, I know that that's what I strived for. You know, I wanted to win every single game. I wanted to score. Sure. I wanted to be, but I also wanted to be.
You wanted to entertain.
Yeah.
Yep. And in that game, that was the entertainment. If you weren't going to score a goal, that's the only other form of entertainment, isn't it?
Yeah, and also, I played with Brett Hull, who made it cool to not even celebrate when he scored. Like, Hully scored so much that it sort of took the glamour out of it. You know, if you score, you score. You're in the next day's article. So-and-so, Marion Gaborik got 2 goals. Well, we know he got 2 goals. Versus...
Let me throw a name out at you, a friend of mine.
Yeah.
We go back a long way.
Yeah.
I don't know if he was as crazy as you or not, but Jeremy Roenick.
Listen, JR paved the way big time. JR is wild. I played with JR in L.A. JR is one of the wildest guys I've ever played with, and I played with some wild ones.
But I like him a lot.
JR is the best. The best. And what a player.
Do I have this right that he was the first American on the ice who would really mix it up?
Well, that's what when I say JR is a legend and paved the way, JR was the first American that had an archetype where it was like, oh, this guy plays hard, you know?
Because they didn't have that rep.
Pat LaFontaine was an American, right? That was his contemporary. Two very different players. JR came into the NHL in the 80s and lit it up. Didn't really care who he pissed off. Didn't play by the rules of, like, he wasn't a Canadian guy. Yeah, JR's a badass. JR gambled hard.
Yep.
JR lived hard. He had styles on his license plate. You know, his Hall of Fame speech, JR sat up there, and in my opinion, it was, he made amends with a lot of people and apologized for a lot of things that he did, which is super unique for a Hall of Fame speech. You know, most guys go up there and they thank people.
Right.
JR legitimately apologized to a lot of people, including his wife.
And then I played a lot of golf with Jeremy, and he at one time was a member of the same club as me in Arizona. By the way, I played hockey players. I think they're the best athlete to pick up the game of golf.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's the slap shot. I don't know what it is. It might be the slap shot. I don't know. But I played a lot of golf with Pierre LaRouche.
Mm-hmm.
Played a lot of golf with Clark Gillies.
Yeah.
I've played golf with Mario. I mean, a lot of them.
Yeah.
And they're great.
Yeah. Brett Hull, great golfer.
Brett.
I think that there's a connection between...
Fuhr.
Yeah, Grant Fuhr, great golfer. By the way. Talk about a guy that, you know, went hard, really went hard. Fierzy, those guys partied hard, those 80s Oilers. But it's the connection. There's something visual about a ball meeting a stick, a puck meeting a blade. You know, we can feel it. Like, there's something tactile in our hands when we go, oh, you're going to give us something and we have to hit something? Like, hit that ball with it. Not like a baseball because we're not grounded. You know, a golf ball's on the ground. Like, you kind of, I don't know. There's something. And I think we also play a lot of it in the off season.
Yeah. I mean, unlike, for instance, I mean, I used to play golf with Yvon Lendl, but he took it up late.
Right.
I mean, it was.
Right.
You all played earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, we played growing
because,
up.
Because hockey wasn't played in the summers.
We didn't play in the summers, and we had to figure out what to do. Yep. Something as simple as that. You know, baseball, they play in the summer.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, maybe the total schedule fluke.
But, it's remarkable. But you said that you don't like it.
No.
Why not?
My son.
I saw your son. You showed me a video of your son.
Nash is
4 years old. He's busting it.
He's one of the greatest 4-year-old golfers of all time.
Okay, Tiger.
I'll actually show you videos of Tiger at 4 and Nash at 4. And it's crazy. I don't want to just be challenged for something that long.
4 hours.
Yeah. Like, there's so much more you could do.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Like, I can go to jiu-jitsu for an hour. And I walk out and I feel like I just did a puzzle with my brain, but also physically. Golf is like a leisurely activity. It's kind of like pickleball.
Well, that I don't understand either.
Either do I. it's so annoying, the sound.
Oh, I heard about that. I mean, I haven't been around.
Oh, wait till you hear it. Oh, you haven't? It's it's like things are popping. You're kind of like looking around and things are, because a tennis ball is a beautiful sound. When you hear a beautiful forehand or a backhand, that's like a symphony. Pickleball's like a fucking nightmare.
So you're 44.
44, right? Yeah.
You are still trying so hard to discover who the fuck you are.
Yeah, but I think I'm in like the sweet spot. Like I can feel where it is, so it feels good. But no question. And honestly, I think when it's all said and done, I might not even be known as an athlete.
Really?
Yeah.
I better rephrase the introduction.
Well, no, I mean, you know, listen, it's still early. 44. I got...
First of all, I was dead broke at 44.
Really?
I mean, really dead broke. At 44, I had just come back. How about this? Starting out in Washington, D.C., where I was a kind of a minor celebrity, trying to say, can I make it somewhere else? And I work in 5 cities in the next 7 years. Wow. Kind of like an itinerant hockey player, right?
Bouncing around
all over. At Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Philadelphia, then back to Washington. And I'm 44. And I got nothing except a guy who believed in me, who brought me back to anchor the news and do a talk show. But money-wise, dead fucking broke.
But you weren't going to stop doing it?
No.
Yeah.
A couple of years later, this wild, crazy Australian buys the television stations. And in a second, I'm off to New York to do this crazy tabloid show called A Current Affair. And the rest is history.
Yeah, well, it's also interesting, like, what did Rupert see in you that he was?
I don't think he knew. For instance, I had just gotten married in 1986. I married in 84, and Connie and I were living in a commuting relationship. I was working in D.C. She was in New York.
Yep.
By the way, it's the greatest marriage in the world. Wow. You know? Commuting.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Right.
Weekends.
Right.
Perfect.
Right.
So. Rupert brings me up to start this show and throws me in with a bunch of Australians that he brought over from Australia to produce this tabloid thing. And he says, well, if this doesn't work out, you'll go back. I said, what is this, like summer camp? I mean, to go back to Washington? He says, yeah, and by the way, maybe you'll find out whether you all can live together. So I start this show, thrown in with all these Australians, have no idea. I said to him, I said, so what's the show? He says, you'll figure it out. And that show ended up being the biggest show for the next 5 years in syndicated television. And, you know, I was almost like 50 before I made any money, any scratch.
Right.
And my parents, they were so worried. My father was so worried that money just burned through me, that there was a hole in my pocket.
Yeah.
So that years later, when he's older, much older, and I'm now doing the talk show and everything's great, and he's originally from Maine, so he's going to Maine from the summer, and I sent a plane to pick him up.
Wow. Wow.
In Washington to pick me up at Teterboro and Connie up at Teterboro.
Wow.
And he's there and he's got all his newspapers spread out in this Gulf Stream. And I walk on there. He says, I'm so happy I did this before he died. He's almost 90. And he says, I'm not going to worry about you anymore. I think everybody should get to the point where their parents don't have to worry about them anymore.
Yeah.
And I was dead in my 50s or 60s before that happened.
Wow. You know, I think what's interesting about the transition that I'm making, rejection is so beautiful. Like, I love rejection.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Why?
The way that we process rejection is like, okay, it's got to be better. You know, as an athlete, you don't have time to go, oh, you know, they didn't like that.
Well, I'll tell you one thing about that, how I can relate to that. I never worried ever about the critics.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the critics just, you know, they pasted me. I mean, uh-huh. they were just killed me. And the talk show, you're exploiting these people. It's all for you and money and them.
Right.
And
yeah.
give me a break.
Yeah.
I can defend myself. Fuck it.
Yeah. Who is to judge who's being exploited in what situation
right.
when we're talking about TV and
right.
entertainment?
Right.
Or even the news.
Exactly.
And by the way, nowadays, everyone has an opinion and the ability to express it. So critics are everywhere.
The critics on news for newspapers and television, they're meaningless anymore.
Yeah.
Because yeah. every person, you know, on every single social moment
yep.
is giving their opinions.
Yeah. You're going to be huge on TikTok, by the way.
Really?
Oh, God.
The show is huge.
No, but.
You well, think this?
Yeah. Oh, they still clip the show gets
oh,
clipped
my.
On TikTok. Oh,
I got
wow.
like 3 or 4 million followers on
yeah.
TikTok.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, TikTok, you're going to go. It's good. It's wild. TikTok is like the wild, wild west of just
really?
Chaos. Yeah. And
well, then I hope it's saved.
It's saved. Yeah.
Right now. We'll
so
see.
Far.
Yeah.
yeah. I play with it a little bit. It's fun. You know.
Good.
You can see anything you want on TikTok.
How do you, in your acting, you're looking obviously for bigger parts, right?
Yeah.
How do you do that? I mean, obviously you have an agent. Agents are, you know, you do have an agent, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, parts are...
I guess it's,
you,
can you find the scripts and can you...
So here's what I'll tell you, okay? Here's what's so crazy about my life. When I finished playing, I did Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, I know you did. You've been ended 2 weeks.
And I got kicked off the show. Like, I was just... They ran a package. I didn't even know what a package was.
Yeah.
They ran a package. The package pissed me off, and I was like, fuck you
guys.
Because
it was all your fights and stuff?
Yeah. yeah. I was like, fuck you guys. You tried to do me dirty. I hate this show. Anyways, the woman that produced the show... Her husband is the biggest casting director in Hollywood.
Huh.
And he's the guy that gives me a lot of breaks.
Oh, really? Good.
He's put me in 2 Christopher Nolan movies, John Papsidera.
Oh, good. You're right about relationships.
The whole and so if I didn't do Dancing with the Stars and like that whole thing. So when you asked me at the beginning, like, what do I regret? Outside of one thing, I don't really regret. I can't look at it as regretful, you know? I'm here right now. I'm going to leave. I'm probably maybe going to go to the Ranger game tonight. I walk around in this city and, like, I feel good because people are excited to see me or right. they're happy to see me. Like, yeah. I provided a service. And I left a lasting impression.
And you're still close to the Rangers.
Yeah.
And you and Dolan have a relationship?
Yeah, yeah. Best owner in professional sports, hands down. No one's even close.
And why would there, and yet there are many people who would say no.
They've been saying that, you know, for so many years. Nobody treats their players better. Nobody else wants
really?
To also win. Like, yeah, I mean, Jim's taking big swings. He wants the best. He wants to bring winners to New York. And I also talk about it from how he treats his players. You know, I got in trouble.
So you would say Messier has nothing but nice things to say about Dolan?
Well, I'm not sure how Mess's relationship was with Jim because Jim came in after 94, right? So that's a little bit different. I don't know who owned the team then. I played for Mr. Dolan. I played.
Paramount owned the team.
Right. I went to rest in peace, his dad's house for the 4th of July. You know, when you think about that family and Charles.
The Dolan?
Yeah.
The old man was.
What a trailblazer.
Unbelievable.
Right?
His vision was unbelievable.
Right? Jim built the Sphere. I went and saw Fish, my favorite band, in the Sphere for 4 nights. It is the greatest entertainment complex.
Well, I tell you, he's taking a lot of risk there.
Yep.
I mean, that's a big nut to crack in terms of expense versus profit.
Yep. But they're building one in Saudi Arabia now.
Yeah.
I've been inside it. As a music fan, as a fan, it's the best venue ever. He owns the Beacon, Radio City. What he's done for New York City, that family, yeah, the best.
So it comes now down to a time at the end when we call this the 19th hole. And I give you an opportunity to ask me three rapid-fire quick questions if you want. I don't know what they are.
Yep.
So
you want my first one?
Have at me.
Where were you on 9/11?
I was across from the Garden working my show at Penn Plaza. And the first plane hits, and I think it's a Piper Cub. And I'm preparing to do the show. And then, 5 minutes later, the second plane hits, and I go, oh, my God, this is really something. So I'm, 50, 60 blocks from where it happened. And I'll never forget this. We left. Now there's ash coming everywhere.
Yeah.
And I walk all the way up to 78th Street on the east side from 34th Street and pick up my son.
At school?
At school.
Wow.
And walk him home.
Wow.
And
where was Connie?
Connie might have been working at ABC at mm-hmm. the time. Where were you?
I was on an exercise bike. Brett Hall was on my right, and Chris Chelios was on my left.
In Dallas?
No, in Detroit.
Oh, in Detroit.
At training camp. September, we always started training camp. We were in Traverse City, Michigan. And I looked over at Brett Hall, and he said, "Welcome to America."
Wow.
And I didn't know. I hadn't lived in America yet, really.
Yeah.
So, okay, my second question. You are a New Yorker.
Well, kind of.
Well.
For 40 years.
Yeah,
okay. I've been held hostage.
You know where all the bodies are buried. What is your relationship with President Trump?
Well, it's an interesting relationship. I haven't seen him in a very long time.
Yep.
We've played golf together. We played in the AT&T together.
Yep.
Or right behind each other. We played at Tahoe together in the celebrity tournament. I covered him on a current when I was doing a current affair with all the divorces and everything with Ivanka and Marla Maples and all of that.
Yep.
I haven't seen him in a very, very long time. He when I was doing my talk show, he called up because we had somebody who was in trouble and needed some medical attention, and he wrote a check. And I haven't seen him for a long time.
Yeah.
And I never would have thought he would have ever been president.
Right.
Ever. I didn't even think he wanted to be president. I think he thought of this as another show.
Right. Another show. Wow. Wow.
And don't you think at times he acts like it's another show?
Well, listen, he's an entertainer.
Exactly.
I mean, he is an entertainer. You know, I think about that question to you as more all the years, like the Trump years in New York were legendary, right?
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
I mean, he gave us such eyeballs.
Right.
You wouldn't believe.
Right.
I mean, everybody was watching everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had biggest ratings in the world with Marla Maples and Ivana and all of that.
Yeah.
In the 90s, it was just late 80s, early 90s. It was unbelievable.
Do you think he has a soft spot for you? Or do you
feel
like...
Oh, I think he does.
Yeah. Okay.
Only because I haven't seen him. And he doesn't know my politics.
Right.
And he doesn't have to.
Yeah. No, he doesn't.
And by the way, I don't have a lot of politics because I've always learned in my original business, we're observers.
Uh-huh.
We just cover the story.
Yeah.
Don't get into it
yeah.
yourself. There's no I
yeah.
in journalism.
Yeah. What happened to that?
I think it really went south.
Well, it did. But why isn't there that honor or that code anymore?
Because the powers that be don't think that you can get any eyeballs watching.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore you have to go another route.
Right.
It's all about numbers.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate.
Right. Huh. Okay, last question. 19th hole, favorite New York City restaurant.
Oh, it's been a lot. In the old days, it was 21 when it was open.
Nice.
It was great.
Nice.
Patsy's on the west side. That nice. Was good.
Nice.
And I eat at home a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, I like the older days in New York before COVID. I mean, it was just different, right?
Yeah, they don't make them like they used to.
No, it was different.
Yeah.
And, I love to go to 21.
I wish. I dream about those, you know. I love
Gallagher's.
I ate there last night.
You did?
By
Still
myself.
Good.
Potato chips. At the bar with a Coke, and I had a steak. Yeah, still good, still great.
It was always a great garden spot.
Fantastic. Wow.
All right, kid. You're the best. Thank you.
Thank you,
Appreciate
sir.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, everybody, for listening to On Par with me, Maury Povich. And be sure to follow us on Instagram at OnParPod. For behind-the-scenes content and updates. And don't forget, you can catch the full episodes on YouTube and everywhere you listen to podcasts. And remember, always keep the conversation going. Stay curious. It'll keep you young. We'll see you next time.
On Par with Maury Povich is brought to you by Mopo Productions, A Better Life Media, and Radley Studios. Executive produced by Maury Povich, Holly J. Mirabella, Christian Thompson, and supervising producer Mike Bornazian.